Good morning, Kansas City. We were going to have Thomas Frank, author of Pity the Billionaire, on today's program. But due to a flight delay and the cold weather, instead the show has become Pity the Vegetarian, as we tackle a hot topic with cold weather outside. This hot topic spawned some criticism among local foodies. It's A.G. Sulzberger's New York Times piece, Meatless in the Midwest. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. As a non-meat eater myself, I can sympathize in some respects with Mr. Sulzberger, but like many here in Kansas City, I believe meeting your dietary needs merely involves taking a look-see at some of the local options. Kansas City, do you agree or disagree with the New York Times piece on being meatless in the Midwest? Call in to Central Standard this morning as we talk to local foodies about the hubbub. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Call in, join the conversation, kick your VeggieTales. We're also available for your comments at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option, and you can tweet at KCURCST. Joining us now is local foodie Pete Doolin to discuss the controversy. Pete, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning.
Now, why do you think this is such a big deal among Kansas City foodies?
Well, I think because there's traditionally been this reputation of Kansas City as a barbecue town, and just historically the association with meat and the stockyards, that's part of the history of Kansas City, and it should be recognized and celebrated, but that's not the entirety of our food scene. And there are ample options for vegetarian dining that I think the writer overlooked in his article.
Pete, I talked to a writer this morning from New York Magazine, Noreen Malone, who wrote an article this morning in response to the Sulzberger piece saying A.G. Sulzberger writes note to dad asking if he could come home yet. Particularly, she took issue with an excerpt from his article that says, in truth, it is less satisfying to be a vegetarian here. Those on the coast have it better. Like many of my brethren, I have instinctively gravitated to cuisine from faraway places where meat is a luxury not all can afford. In New York, this meant frequenting Indian restaurants, Thai, Ethiopian, et cetera, et cetera. When I talked to Noreen on the phone, she says she's a Midwesterner who has eaten many vegetables in the Midwest. She didn't have time to come on. She had a meeting and didn't want to really comment further. But you agree with her? She's a Midwesterner. There are vegetables here, right?
There's an abundance of vegetables. I mean, Kansas City is, you know, and the Midwest is America's breadbasket. You know, we're blessed in that we're a major metro city, this urban area that's surrounded by lots of farmland. So there are a lot of agricultural producers on a large and small scale. So, you know, while we do have four seasons, unlike, say, California, where you can get certain types of produce year-round, getting fresh produce is not a challenge, both for consumers as well as wholesale, you know, for restaurants.
Tell us about your experiences with fresh vegetables here as a food blogger, as someone who eats out and sits in and cooks. What has your experience been?
Well, there's just no shortage at any time of year. One of the great places to go for local produce is Bad Seed. It's a farmer's market that's every Friday down in the crossroads, and they feature produce from local farmers. And even in the wintertime, they still offer winter produce that's available. You can go to Asian markets in the east side of town and find an array of fresh produce, herbs, bok choy, long beans, you name it, if you are doing Asian cooking, Thai, Vietnamese, Chinese, and just, you know, in the mainstream supermarkets.
Brooke Salvaggio, who you mentioned, is with Bad Seed. She's been a frequent guest on Central Standard. A lot of people laud the community as a community where there are fresh vegetables, fresh produce, and with an emphasis that it's local. We have Judy from Lawrence, who wants to get in on the conversation. Judy, welcome to Central Standard.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking me so soon. I have a couple of things. And first of all, I've been a vegetarian for decades. And the first thing is not just about fresh produce. It's also about protein. And that's a really serious problem in a lot of places, including sometimes on the coast. So it's not just fresh produce, but it's also getting protein in your meals. And then the second thing is that one thing that he mentioned that I think people sort of forget about is when you go, for example, to a Mexican restaurant and it looks like you're ordering something vegetarian. In fact, it has lard in it. And a lot of us just compromise. We just sort of pretend the lard isn't there. But if you're really serious about it, that's a problem. But then the third thing I wanted to say is that absolutely the picture they painted of the Midwest was such a caricature and so completely false, because there's fabulous cuisine here. Everyone knows this. I'm sure your other guests will say that. And I want to thank you very much for the show.
Well, Judy, before you go, give us some examples of vegetarian options that either Mr. Sulzberger or critics of vegetarianism in the Midwest might have overlooked.
Oh, well, gosh, in Lawrence, I mean, Pachamama's has a fantastic lunchtime vegetarian menu. They have, you know, terrific, like, fritters, and they're fabulous veggie burgers all over the place. In the spring, they have this vegetable crepes that has a big dab of ricotta cheese on the side, and it's terrific. Almost any Italian restaurant will have terrific vegetarian meals. Asian restaurants have terrific vegetarian meals. Some Mexican restaurants are very sensitive to the lard issue and will have non-lard options. There's a lot of stuff. I mean, I couldn't begin to say. There's just fantastic stuff. There are a few places that really have an anti-vegetarian
We seem to have been cut off from our caller from Lawrence, but we do have Pete Doolin back on the air. Pete, what do you feel? Do you feel that this is bigger than a food critic or one man story about being a vegetarian and sort of about the culture wars around food and about being cosmopolitan? Do you think it has something to do with that?
Absolutely. I mean, not to overstate the writer's intent, because I haven't spoken with him and I don't know him, but I think there's a little bit of a snobbery, if you will, about what's available in New York or other major metro cities versus, you know, Kansas City and some of the other cities he mentioned in the Midwest. The truth is that Kansas City has so many offerings, as your other guest, Judy, had mentioned, dining-wise, you know, with there's probably a perception that, you know, Kansas City is one of those meat and potato towns. But in truth, we have an abundance of ethnic cuisine, Thai, Vietnamese, Indian, Chinese, Italian, where you can find many vegetarian options. Then you have an abundance of fine dining restaurants at all different price points where you can find vegetarian options as well. And you know, I could go on and on about the local options. And I don't think the writer spent a lot of time investigating the local scene.
Well, it was a very controversial article. A lot of people think that he didn't go as far as he needed to do in exploring the local options. But in his defense, he is a very good writer. And we did, on Central Standard, reach out to the New York Times this morning to garner his comments, but don't think he's going to call in to try to defend that. But if you want to talk about it, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We've been talking about A.G. Sulzberger's piece on being meatless in the Midwest. Once again, call in to Central Standard with your comments, with your VeggieTales, with your favorite veggie spots. We're also available at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option. You can also tweet at KCUR CST. Now, what is the first thing a person needs to know as a foodie who comes from the coast about the local cuisine here, Pete Doolin? What would you dispel them about first? What myth would you dispel first?
Well, I think first of all that it's a limited offerings. Whether we're talking about vegetarian cuisine or just generally speaking, the food scene in Kansas City has really elevated itself over the past 10 years. And then, I mean, if you go farther back, you know, there have been plenty of restaurants that have had a storied history going back to places on 39th Street, known as Restaurant Row. And, you know, I think in the past 10 years, 5 years, certainly, there have been an abundance of restaurants that have opened up and proven that our cuisine is comparable to many other places around the country. We have award-winning chefs. We, you know, just in the past year or two, we've had a lot of chefs be nominated for James Beard Awards and have won that prestigious award. We're written up in national press, food-wise, on a regular basis. You know, Blue Stem is just one of the places. Over at Julian, you have Selena Teo, who's an award-winning chef at The American. Debbie Gold, you know, also is well-known. So there are plenty of offerings and that are being produced by great quality chefs around town. And it's Kansas City is a food town that's worth exploring.
A frequent guest, Jose Faust, has said as much. Kansas City is a food town. We got David in Overland Park who'd like to comment on the veggie hysteria. David, welcome to Central Standard.
How are you?
Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The only thing I was wanting to comment on is that a lot of people, in fact, I almost never hear anybody mention the fact that some people, well, everybody has a different kind of blood type, first of all.
Right.
And some people will thrive on a vegetarian diet, while other people will not.
Right.
And it turns out that the different blood types have different kinds of dietary requirements.
Well, let's talk about that for a little bit, David. Different blood types have different dietary requirements. Vegetarianism is seen in a lot of circles as more of a cultural choice. How do you feel about vegetarians coming to a meat town and saying that there's no options?
How do I feel about it?
How do you feel about it, Dave? You're on live. How do you feel about it?
As long as you have the blood type that, you know, can utilize a vegetarian diet, by all means, it should be available to you. I have no problem with it, anybody being a vegetarian. Personally, I have the most common, most primitive blood type, and I thrive on an almost carnivorous diet. My daughter, on the other hand, doesn't. She needs her vegetables, and she needs them regularly.
Well, thank you, David, for your comments. Pete Doolin, people have different dietary needs and different dietary restrictions. Is there a bias against vegetarianism here in KC?
I don't think so. Absolutely not. If you're going out to eat, then most independent restaurants are more than happy to make accommodations if they don't already have vegetarian options on their menu. But in my experience in dining out, there are plenty of options available, whether it's ethnic cuisine or contemporary American. And, you know, local chefs, they're very accommodating. Whether it's, you know, you need a gluten-free dish or you're vegetarian or some other dietary need. So I don't think it's as much of a challenge as some people might think.
Pete, we've addressed this with our joint ventures with Harvest Public Media on whether vegetarianism and fresh local foods or fresh local produce is indeed a class thing. Is vegetarianism or fresh local food something for upper middle class foodies or elitist? What do you think about that idea?
Well, I think that's an argument that you can take either side on and will get batted around for a long time to come. You know, depending on where you live in an urban area, there may be easier access or more difficult access to fresh produce. You know, there's Kansas City as well as a lot of other places around the country have been designated as I forget the exact term, but like a food desert. where there, you know, there's certain urban areas where there may not be an abundance of grocery stores that offer fresh produce. And so people in that area may rely on manufactured goods. So, you know, Kansas City is not unique in that respect. But by and large, there are a variety of options, whether you're buying food to cook at home or, again, dining out.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We've been talking about being meatless in the Midwest, the center of the controversy around A.G. Sulzberger's piece in the New York Times, Meatless in the Midwest, and the local reaction that's been blowing up on Facebook and Twitter and trending around the KC metro area. We've been talking to local foodie and blogger Pete Doolin about how the reaction is going in the city, what the vegetarian options are, and what food tastes are in general. We're going to go to Bob in South KC. Bob, welcome to Central Standard.
Bolani.
Hey.
Thank you, Javalani. It's a pleasure to be on this snowy day. You know, there's no question. I'm in my 60s, and there's no question that we've gone many, many, many miles. But however, you get out of Kansas City, and the farmland that we're rich in is planted in soybeans and corn.
Is that part of the problem, Bob?
That was what we're overcoming. That's what the food circle is overcoming. That's what Stephen, who I went to go pick up my organic produce, who grows it out here south of Belton, has been overcoming over the last 10 years. And many of the restaurants that the high end restaurants you've mentioned, such as Julian's, has one alternative. They have 15 different eight different meat choices, but only one alternative for vegetables, which is, I congratulate them. But it leaves someone like me who's attempting to eat maybe meat. I'll let myself eat meat once a month or once every couple of weeks and prefers to eat vegetables, and would rather have an interesting vegetable dish, but we're not as always seeing these interesting vegetable dishes on these high-end menus. Room 39 usually has one.
Pete, you want to chime in on this? The farm culture that is very sort of monochromatic in terms of its planting of corn and soybeans sort of takes away the local food option in a lot of places. Can you comment on that?
Sure, absolutely. You know, going back to the article in question, I think, you know, the writer kind of made that point as well in his travels.
A good point.
I think it's a fair point that when you get outside of major metro areas and you're traveling to smaller towns, there are less options. There are fewer options. I think that's a valid point. And in response to the caller's comment, I would say that as far as independent restaurants, whether you're in the city or out in the country, they're driven by demand. And if, you know, you have enough people coming in and asking for more vegetarian options, inquiring about it or seeing if the chef can accommodate that, then if there's enough demand, eventually there'll be more options put out there.
We got Jeremy in Raytown. Excuse me, Pete Doolin. Jeremy,
yes.
Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thanks, Jabalani. I was just calling to say, first of all, I am not a vegetarian. I moved to Kansas City about 10 years ago, and the first thing I fell in love with was the barbecue. But I also, just because of the job I was doing, I ended up having a fair amount of health conscious and vegetarian friends. And I thought, oh no, here, whenever we have to go out to lunch or something, and I figured, well, we're going to have to figure some place to go. But I have always been pleasantly surprised by the amount of options for eating out around here. And two places that I'm sure anyone who is a vegetarian in Kansas City knows about, I wanted to mention first, Eden Alley at the in the basement of Unity Temple on the Plaza. That's some of the best food I've ever had, and I don't know that they serve any meat at all. I know they do have gluten-free options also. I believe, I'm not sure that they're open for dinner, but their lunch is just fantastic, and they've given me a lot of ideas for cooking things at home, even. Also, I love Sweet Tomatoes, sort of a salad and soup place on 75th and State Line.
Well, Jeremy, thanks for your points on that, and thanks for your offers on the restaurants. Pete Doolin, a lot of the criticism of the article Meatless in the Midwest by the New York Times' Kansas City correspondent A.G. Sulzberger centered around the fact that he seemed to have ignored the local farmers markets with produce that comes from actual farms and the option to go to the farmers market, get the produce, and cook at home. I'm assuming he's a busy man, but the criticism in the article is that he left that out. Expound on that.
Well, I think that's a huge oversight. I mean, the farmers market in Kansas City is one of the oldest farmers markets in the country west of the Mississippi. There's a long history of having produce available from local farms, and that's accessible to people wanting to cook at home. I mentioned earlier there are specialty farmers markets like Bad Seed where you can buy items as well. So I think it's a big oversight. I mean, fresh produce, fresh meat, that's all part of America's Kansas City's history as growing from this agricultural region into a contemporary metropolis where you still have access to that type of food.
Jenny from Leawood, welcome to Central Standard. Sorry about that, Pete. Jenny, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you for having me on. I was calling. For years, I owned restaurants with my husband, Mohammed, and he is from Egypt. And when vegetarians would come in, he was able to come up with dishes. They weren't necessarily on the menu, but he could make it, anything. Anytime you go to a small restaurant, especially an ethnic restaurant, they grow up without a lot of meat options. So they know how to make something that tastes fabulous without meat. We sell a local hummus in grocery stores, so I know there's great products out there. So just to put a note on, really, we owned restaurants from, and I was in the top 100 restaurants in the country when I owned them. For ethnic restaurants are just a hidden, and any vegetarian knows that, it's just a hidden spot. And people have to remember, when you're running a restaurant, it's expensive to run, and so they don't always have, just because they have one thing listed on the menu for a vegetarian doesn't mean they can't come up with other items for anybody's diet. They're always willing to work with you.
So, Jenny, would you say there are plenty of vegetarian items and options
like
here in the metro area?
I would like to go toe-to-toe with that writer.
You would like to go toe-to-toe with A.G. Sulzberger?
Sure. He can come over to my house for dinner, and I guarantee you Muhammad could put on a feast that he'd just be in awe going, wow, really? We eat vegetarian all the time. And, I mean, both of us eat meat, so don't get me wrong. But like I said, we sell a hummus. I have 7 flavors of hummuses, just in hummus. There's tons of options in Kansas City. I so disagree with that guy.
Well, thank you, Jenny. Mr. Sulzberger, a lot of people disagree with you, including Jenny from Leawood and Pete Doolin, who's been our guest this half hour, talking about the article Meatless in the Midwest. A lot of consternation, a lot of criticism. Pete, thank you for joining us here on Central Standard, and hopefully we'll get AG to come in and defend himself and expound on that. When we return, we talk with Thomas Frank, who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas? More culture war discussions, and his new book is called Pity the Billionaire. We'll have him when we come back on Central Standard. Stay tuned. And welcome back to Central Standard. In the Capital Markets trade publication, Trader Monthly, read mostly by Wall Street traders, there's a story about a $300,000 record player and turntable, which the magazine promises will serve as a huge middle finger to anyone who enters the home of the purchaser of said turntable. These types of invitations to the unapologetic sweet life, our next guest argues, symbolize the opulence that has created a class war where the political stakes are as high as they've ever been. And joining us now is Thomas Frank, who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas and now has a new book called Pity the Billionaire. He's a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal and currently writes a monthly column for Harper's Magazine. Thomas, welcome to Central Standard.
It's great to be here.
What happened this morning with your flight, man?
Oh, you don't even want to know. They actually moved us off of one plane and onto another. They tried to take off twice and failed, and then had to do this switcheroo with the planes. But now I'm out here at KCI.
Could it be that Thomas, that your book is so controversial that even nature didn't want you to talk about it?
it's the god of the market slapped that plane down with the invisible hand.
The invisible hand, certainly. Now, Pity the Billionaire, a very provocative title. Why did you choose that title, and what does it mean for today's times?
It's sarcastic. It's my way of sort of poking fun at the political movements that you see out there in America right now. I mean, we're in this very perverse situation. You've seen in the last couple of years the greatest, failure of free market theory ever in my lifetime. And I would actually go farther than that. I'd say it's the greatest sort of ideologically driven failure since the fall of the Soviet Union. Now, what's our response to it? Our response to it is our political system's response is to have, the conservative movement has, shifted itself way to the right and is demanding that we sort of double down in our commitment to this ideology.
Before we get into the conservative movement and how they've co-opted it, as you argue in your book, tell us about this live and let die culture that you describe among Wall Street traders that is a big part of what brought us into this mess.
It's the story of a magazine called Trader Monthly. It actually went out of business in the first few months of the Great Recession. But I went back, and when they went out of business, I went back and looked at a bunch of their back issues. And this is a magazine that just sort of worshipped the not so much what the trader did, because a guy say trading commodity futures on the Chicago Board of Trade or something like that. They don't really care about what the trader does, what his economic function is, but about the awesome things that a trader could buy with his incredible earnings. And you remember, this is a magazine in the middle of the last decade when the Wall Street types were pulling down such fantastic bonuses. And what's shocking about it is that it was all done in this kind of tone of worship for antisocial behavior, like that turntable passage that you just read from the book, where the turntable was supposed to fly a big middle finger to the guests at your home. Now, why on earth would anyone want to do that? To spend $300,000 to do something like that? But that's sort of typical of that era.
You sort of argue that everything, getting into the political sphere, you argue that everything FDR and the Keynesian economic theorists did in the Depression has been co-opted by Republicans and turned into a new sort of faux populism. Can you elaborate on that? That's pretty much the premise of your book.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's that you've got out there in the land, we have a movement that appears to be a populist movement, okay? I mean, they do a very convincing interpretation of it. They're out there in the parks with megaphones, screaming about the banksters, which is a word from the 1930s, and talking about the Boston Tea Party and talking about, using all these sort of classic American symbols. And it looks for all the world like a social protest movement from the 1930s. Okay. But if you scratch beneath the surface, the politics of it are completely the reverse of what they were in the 1930s. I mean, the politics of this movement this time around, essentially, promise to bring us right back to the days when Trader Monthly was riding high, And so what I often say is that they swiped populism, they stole populism, and they delivered it to, you might say, the Park Avenue, the people on Park Avenue in New York City.
What would you say to conservative critics who say, just as with what's the matter with Kansas, that you are maybe propagating regional biases and feeding the flame of culture wars?
Well, you mean like regional biases against...
Against the people against, in Kansas from your last book,
Well, you could say that if you want, but I'm from Kansas. That's the
right,
you know,
right, right.
And the other thing is, I don't know if you're aware of this, but I mean, I didn't put it in this book, but I'm a strong critic of the sort of culture of Washington D.C. In fact, I'm one of the. I mean, I write about it all the time. That is a city that really annoys me. We can talk about that on some other occasion. But your listeners would probably really enjoy my my take on. Even your conservative listeners would probably really enjoy my take on Washington D.C. You know, it's the richest city in America right now. I'll tell you about that some other time.
But... Well, to that end, leading into this next question, do you think the Occupy Wall Street movement should really have been an Occupy Washington movement?
As a matter of fact, I do think that, you know, they're out there in Wall Street, and I, you know, I'm one of the people that thought that they were, that they had the story correct, that they had it right, you know, that they're, I am the 99% protest campaign. I thought that was right on target. But, you know, they're out there on Wall Street calling for bringing back bank regulation. Okay. I'm in favor of that. I think we never should have got rid of the, you know, the Glass-Steagall Act or a lot of the 1930s-era bank regulation. They're out there calling for that, but it's not Wall Street that did that. I mean, Wall Street's money did it. Their lobbyists did it. But the way they did it was in Washington, D.C.
Well, why hasn't there been more rancor about occupying Washington, do you think? Why haven't protesters showed up at Capitol Hill?
They have, but they haven't. There's not very many of them, and they haven't got a lot of media attention. You know, I'll tell you, the conservative movement was started their protests just right, you know, right off the gun. The first Tea Party protest was in February 2009, and by the way, I happened to go to it. It's one of my, you know, I've been interested in this since the start. But it was less than a month after Barack Obama had been inaugurated as president. Okay, the sort of response to the Tea Party movement, Occupy Wall Street, took 3 full years from the day of the financial crisis to the, you know, when they finally showed up in lower Manhattan and started protesting. And that's a hell of a long lag time, you know. But at least it's off the ground now. You know, at least they're doing something now. But frankly, the conservatives are way ahead of them in money, in organization, and, you know, the electoral results. You know, they've been able to achieve all kinds of things.
You say in your book that regulators and the regulated become indistinguishable. Is it a problem from both sides of the political aisle in terms of regulation and Wall Street's lobby money? You argue that in the book. Can you elaborate on that? Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that both sides, both political sides, agree that this happens. There's no question about it. I mean, this is, by the way, this is something that anybody that has spent a lot of time watching Washington D.C. knows that this goes on. That I'll give you some of the classic examples from the, you know, presidency of George W. Bush, you know, who sort of rolled back supervision on Wall Street banks in all kinds of ways, and not just Wall Street banks, but predatory lenders across the country, and, you know, sort of fly by night mortgage originators. And these people were basically, there was no supervision of them at all. And why is that? Well, because the lobbyists in D.C. wrote the laws, but also there's the regulatory agencies that did exist would be, and this was routine. This happened all the time. They would be turned over to lobbyists from the industries that were supposedly being regulated. And the classic example is the guy who is the head of the Office of Thrift Supervision under President Bush, and this is one of the bank regulators. They regulated some of the biggest banks ever to fail in this country. There's a famous photo op with this guy, where he was from the industry. By the way, he was from the banking industry, and he's meeting with a bunch of lobbyists, and they're having this big photo op, and they've all brought like garden implements to cut through symbolic red tape. They've got all this red tape there, and they're going to cut through it. And the regulator himself brought a chainsaw, right, to prove, you know, that he could outdo even the lobbyists, you know, in his hostility to bank regulation. And this is the guy that's supposed to be enforcing the law.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is writer Thomas Frank, The premise of his new book, Pity the Billionaire, is that in the wake of fiscal and financial calamities, conservatives have seen what he calls a surreal resurgence. Kansas City, is our current political culture benefiting, actually, from our economic troubles? Join the conversation with your thoughts and questions, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can shoot us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. You can also comment on Facebook and @KCURCST is our Twitter handle. Mr. Frank, what do you think of critics of the current economic policy who may have short memories about the bailout, the wars, and the lax regulatory culture of the Bush administration, which were a big part of what we're facing now? How do you explain that amnesia?
Well, that's a really good question. That's sort of the main question of the book. How can we overlook this lesson that we were just taught in a really painful way? And I think one of the things that made it possible was that you have two separate outrages. The one outrage is the financial crisis and all the crazy bank misbehavior that led up to it. The second one, though, is the bailouts. Okay, and the bailouts, that was fully bipartisan, and that was a total abomination. I mean, that is an insult to anyone, you know, who pays taxes and reads newspapers. You know, everyone was angry about that, left and right. You know, it just doesn't matter. Everybody was furious about it, and it was started by the Bush administration with his Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson. You remember at the very tail end of his President Bush's time in office, Hank Paulson was really running the country. And then it was all of this was accepted by the new Obama administration, and they made all these signals that they were not going to change the bailout policy. Everything was going to continue. And so essentially Barack Obama took ownership of that really poisonous, really toxic issue of bank bailouts. And frankly, that's the issue where the conservatives really have a point, okay? And they've been able to, you know, they don't really talk so much about the financial crisis, but they do talk about the bailouts, and they talk about them constantly. In some ways, the bailouts are their ace in the hole.
Right. And given that, you mentioned that the Obama administration and Democrats aren't to be let off the hook either. You said the bailout was bipartisan, but you said in particular that Democrats have become a tongue-tied, expert-worshipping species, essentially making their policies and message ineffectual. Talk about that a little bit.
That is exactly right. Well, you know, I live in D.C. these days, or in the suburbs of it anyway, and I spend a lot of time wondering about how the Democrats there manage to get things so wrong, I'm talking to you and making it all sound like, you know, the solutions are so obvious and everything, but they aren't at all. The Democrats in Washington have real trouble speaking to or even understanding all the anger that's out there in the country. So you have the Tea Party movement that springs up, and you have the conservative movement generally shifts itself to the right. The Republican Party shifts itself to the right. People are furious about what has happened. And the president, though, seems incapable of speaking to that anger. And I think the larger reason for that is that Democrats, they don't feel comfortable with discontent or with anger of the kind that you see at Tea Party rallies. They think of themselves as a party of experts and expertise and professionals. That's who they are. They're the party of people that went to college, you know, and their leader is a guy that has that went to got a JD from Harvard and was a professor at the University of Chicago. You know, he's got the perfect academic resume. But it's not just Barack Obama. This goes back many years. You know,
Clinton, many people may recall, was also highly educated at an Ivy League school. Even though he was a better retail politician, he still took a pragmatic, more centrist approach as well.
That's right. And centrism, that's the word. The Democratic Party is in love with the idea of centrism, with the idea that the president, or a Democratic president anyway, should always sort of triangulate between his supporters. Triangulate was the word that Clinton used for it, but there are others, you know. Triangulate between his own core constituency and the other side. Now, of course, Republicans know this because they say it openly, right? It's obviously part of their strategy. And, you know, the Republicans talk about how they're able to game this system. You know, if he's going to keep shifting over, anyhow, it's very easy to sort of work a Democratic president when they've made their – when their official policy is this kind of bipartisanship. You just keep moving the goalposts constantly, and they keep following you. And what's really sad about that is that's that the Democrats don't ever seem to catch on to that. It never – it's never like they you know, for all their learning and all their brilliance, they can't figure out the failures of the sort of centrist strategy, and they can't speak to – you know, a very angry public. And the public has, in my view, a perfect right to be furious these days. They ought to be angry these days. And in the past, Democrats used to – that used to be what who they were. You know, you look at like William Jennings Bryan or Harry Truman or something like that, or Andrew Jackson. That's who Democrats were. They spoke to that public sense of outrage. You know, the country is coming apart between the very rich and everybody else. And in that kind of situation, I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day, and the way he put it is like, it's like playing t-ball. I mean, the ball is just sitting there right on the tee for someone like Andrew Jackson or Franklin Roosevelt to come along and smack a home run.
But you argue in your book, Thomas, that those type of guys aren't around. Let's get Gary in Midtown in on the conversation. Gary, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you very much. I have a question for your guest, which is. To my view, there's a way to articulate the Wall Street bailout that I've never heard, but it makes complete sense, and I'm just mystified by why nobody's done this. Why is it that no congressperson who was against the Wall Street bailouts didn't portray the Wall Street bailout as a giant cash transfer from numerous congressional districts throughout the country, such as theirs, into just a limited number of districts, specifically the district in which Wall Street sits, and by extension, by executive salaries, the districts in which the Wall Street financiers live? I'll take my answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. We lost Thomas Frank. We're going to get him back in the meantime. We're on with Thomas Frank, the best-selling author with a new book called Pity the Billionaire. He's a former opinion columnist for the Wall Street Journal and currently with Harper's Magazine. A good deal of the public has been led to believe, the book argues, that the regulation of big corporation is the same as those of small business, and that big business conservatives are for the little guy, and that cheating on Wall Street has been rewarded, and current policies will keep the average Joe from ever becoming rich. Those are the sentiments of our guest who's rejoining us. Thomas, what do you think about that?
Well, that's a pretty good statement of what I write about in the book, that there's people often confuse the sort of, you know, at the small business level, government regulation is very intrusive. You know, people have to fill out all kinds of forms. I mean, I file a Schedule C, so I know about how annoying it can be, you know, and so we you know, a small business person looks at the last, you know, 20 years and they say, what deregulation? I haven't seen any deregulation. You know, what are you talking about? But, you know, we know this is what happened. The deregulation is what happened with the banks. You know, the rules got rolled back and allowed to go unenforced in all kinds of ways. But that's often not something that we see in our own individual lives, so it's difficult for us to perceive it.
Well, Thomas, can we back up just a little and address the caller's question as we lost you off the air a few moments ago? He wants you to address the sort of assertion that the bailout was simply a transfer of wealth from us, the taxpayer, to the Wall Street banks, and by extension, the Wall Street constituency in districts where Wall Street bankers lived. Can you address that caller's assertion?
Well, that is more or less true. They, as is well known, those banks are, you know, back up on their feet now, paying bonuses and all that sort of thing, and they by and large have not been brought under new regulatory scrutiny. And one of the things that drives me crazy when you think about the bailouts in the last few years is that when the taxpayers step in and come to the rescue of, you know, these very wealthy people and these very wealthy institutions, or institutions that, well, actually they weren't wealthy at the time. They should have been, frankly, they should have been insolvent. Their businesses should have been wound up. But when you do that, you can do that as a matter of policy, go to the rescue of Wall Street. But you have to bring new measures to make sure that they don't do it again, that the management of these companies is removed, you know, that the people who are in charge aren't looting the companies, you know, because once you say you're going to rescue them, it gives them a cushion. It gives them, you know, They don't have, you know, an airbag. They don't have to worry about screwing up again. And so they can do all kinds of you know, ledger demand and various tricks that it's very easy to, at financial institutions to do in order to sort of loot the institution, because they know the taxpayers are gonna come back in again and save them. And you have to make sure that that's not going to happen.
Well, Thomas,
we didn't do that this time around.
Thomas, when you explain in your book that under the current system, playing by the rules for the middle class and, for that matter, the poor, was a chump's game. Explain that.
That is the impression that people like me got when I was watching the Wall Street bailouts. I'm speaking there in the first person.
Right.
That's what I felt like when I watched this thing happening. That these guys who were just seemed to be so crooked were going to, you know, not only get out of trouble, but were going to be rewarded with, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, amounts of money that are beyond, you know, of personal wealth that are beyond the comprehension of average people. And I'm thinking about the work that I do, which, you know, it's writing, yes, but it's hard. I mean, it's hard work. I like everybody else, I have a job and I work hard at it. And it's a matter of scraping and saving and trying to get by. And why do I do it when, you know, when this kind of behavior is rewarded so lavishly? And that's, and then, you know, to take a step back, that's the political situation of our time. That sense of anger and, you know, of watching cheaters and looters be rewarded. And, you know, you wonder, you know, it's easy to see in such a situation how the conservative movement has made this amazing comeback. But the bigger question, though, is how did the Democrats drop the ball here?
Right. Define capitalism before we get into that. Before we get into that Democratic distinction, define capitalism for us in your estimation. Have we ever lived in a truly capitalist society? You make some arguments in your book that it's more crony, and that some of the Keynesian policies and socialist policies, socialized failure, in other words, have been adopted. Define capitalism for us, right?
Well, I would say that yes, we do live in a capitalist country, but I would also say that it was a capitalist country in the 1940s, in the 1950s, in the 1960s, when you had bank regulations in place and you had, you know, regulation of all manner of things. You know, you had the, you know, an EPA, and did you hear that? Someone is sawing a pipe right behind me. So I think capitalism, that when people talk about a pure form of capitalism, there's never been one. There's never been a pure free market system, I should say. Capitalism, you know, a system where you have markets, you know, that's what we live in now and what we always have had in America. But the idea of achieving a kind of pure free market state, I think, is a fool's errand. I think it's impossible, because free markets, by their nature, have rules. You have to have rules, or you don't have a market. And so it's up to us as a public and our political leaders to make those rules. And those rules can include things like Social Security, you know, or some kind of national health care system.
Well, Thomas Harry from Leawood wants to know, what's wrong with the Democrats relying on expert consultation? You said in your book that the Democrats have sort of become these people that rely on charts and expert crazy and ineffectual. What's wrong, asks Harry from Leawood, with Democrats relying on expert consultation?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because, you know, it's actually really refreshing to have people in Washington who take experts seriously after the, you know, the Bush administration and its various wars on, you know, on evolution or global warming or, you know, all these attacks that they would make on scientists. It's nice finally to see.
But what's wrong with it? But what's wrong with it?
I'm getting to that. The problem is that they often make a cult of it. And the Democrats will say things like, and this was especially true during the debate over the health care reforms, you know, that they wouldn't give you a good political or philosophical reason why we were doing this. They'd say, well, this is what the experts say we should do. We should use this system rather than that system. And they did this with the stimulus package, too. Instead of going out there and fighting for it and campaigning for it in the way that, say, a Franklin Roosevelt would have done, the current administration said, the experts, you know, economists tell us we need to do this, and that's why we're doing it. So they make it supplants the sort of the political and philosophical arguments that they should be making, and frankly, they should be winning. right now.
Thomas,
and
we got time for one more question, and then you can get in from KCI and come and enjoy your day in the snow.
Wait just a minute.
Judging from your book, you don't think economic policy in this tug of war is going to necessarily end that well. You say the problems will get worse in your last paragraph of the book. Do you care to elaborate as we close?
Oh, man. You know, I want people to come to my – I'm doing a book reading tonight.
I was going to mention that. Can you answer the question real quick before we leave?
All right. I'm a pretty negative guy. I'm a pessimistic guy, and I was going to save that stuff for the end. But you know what? I am pessimistic about it because this has been a real test for my liberals, and they failed it as far as I'm concerned. And I don't see them getting back up on their feet anytime soon and figuring out the sort of things that they need to do to win these debates, which they have to do not just for their own political future, but for the health of the nation.
Well, that's a good forward sale. We've been discussing best-selling author's new book, Thomas Frank, Pity the Billionaire. He'll be speaking and signing copies of his new book tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Thank you for joining us, and enjoy the weather, Mr. Frank.
I will. You know it.
Tune in tomorrow for the Walt Bodine Show with the Food Critics. Today's show was produced by Tamika Weatherspoon with help from Danny Alexander. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi, executive produced by Bill Anderson. Kim Noble is our announcer. Emily Mutert manages our website. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney. What you're hearing right now, the outro, by the Wilnots. Up to Date is next. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy the show. Enjoy the day. Stay warm. Goodbye.